our guest speaker for the day, because I know nobody knows him here. Now, of course, Harrison grew up here. He's the son of Mike and Amber, and we're proud of the path he's taken. And he has just finished his freshman year at Freed Hardeman University. He'll be working again this summer as a youth intern at the Centerville congregation. So we're sure glad to have Harrison with us today.
I hear my dad speak for so many years, and he doesn't show up for the one time that I speak. He's listening online. I couldn't help but take a jab at him. We'll be in Ecclesiastes chapter 9, if you want to go ahead and be turning there. And while you're turning there, I want to tell you how grateful I am to have the opportunity to come speak here. I can't quite say I remember it, but I know the stories. Me down that hall when Dad was a minister here, and I'd stand up on a chair behind a podium and preach. I think I mostly just said Jesus loves you over and over again, but there's probably nothing I could say up here that's more effective than that. But I'm very honored that you would all have me out here to speak. I also don't know if it's been announced yet. I figured I'd say, as Darren mentioned, I am the youth intern again at Centerville. They asked me to speak tonight, and being just the youth intern, I can't quite tell them no. So my good friend Josh Copley is going to speak this afternoon. He's a much better speaker than I am, so I know he'll probably redeem the Sunday after I'm done speaking. So we'll see how that goes. So before we begin, I want to start with a question. Are you happy? Are you truly happy? Why or why not? I read a story Dan Miller wrote on his blog about a farmer who had grown discontent with his farm. He always found something to complain about. He talked about his lake always needing the fish to be thinned. His rolling hills made it hard to run fence lines. It was too dark to walk back from the barn at night. He couldn't find his way back to his house. And the hills were so expansive that he couldn't see his cattle half of the time. He decided he wanted to move. He called his real estate agent and had his house listed. A few days later, he was reading a newspaper looking for where he would decide to live later. And his eye was caught by a listing about a farm with a traditional barn on it and plenty of green grass and natural flowers. It was on rolling hills that were expansive. It was far enough away from the city that it was untouched by lights and by noisy traffic, but it was close enough to be convenient. It had a lake that was filled with bass, and it had cattle that came with it. He read it two or three times before he realized that that was his own listing that was in the newspaper. He called his real estate agent and immediately told her, "I've changed my mind. I've been looking for a place like this to live my whole life." Someone recently said, "We live in the most technologically advanced generation the world has ever known. We enjoy inventions our grandparents couldn't imagine. We have smartphones, smart TVs, smart cars, and smart homes. No generation has ever enjoyed our privileges. If having more could make us happy, then we'd be the happiest people in the world. But we're not. We're miserable, neurotic, unhappy, confused, and dissatisfied. We're hung up, uptight, frustrated, and extremely materialistic. Our marriages fail, our homes break up, our children struggle, and our lives don't hold together. We've got it all, but it's still not enough. But happiness doesn't come from what we don't have. It doesn't come from searching for what we might want. It comes from learning to appreciate what we already have. We as a society are almost trained to constantly be searching for the next big thing, to believe that grass is greener on the other side, and always to think that we have to be searching for something, we have to obtain something in order to be happy, but this simply is not the case. Take heed and beware of covetousness, for a man's life does not consist of the abundance of the things of which he possesses. That's Luke 12:15. Jesus said that. He later rounds out that passage in verse 21 saying that contentment and peace don't come from materialistic wealth, but from being rich towards God. The great apostle Paul said that godliness with contentment is great gain in 1 Timothy 6:6. But contentment is a hard lesson to learn, and as we'll get into this, Solomon learned it. In Ecclesiastes, he writes about it. But it took him a whole lifetime. It took him a lifetime of searching. He had more than any of us could ever imagine. He experienced everything. And by the end of his life, when he was writing Ecclesiastes, he looked back when he had learned contentment and realized that it wasn't searching for things that made us content. This morning, we're going to talk from this passage, speak on three things that Solomon has learned about the infinite God, the insanities of life, and then finally some instructions for life that he gives us. I'll begin with the reading, again, Ecclesiastes chapter 9, starting in verse 7. I don't know what that was. Go, eat your bread with joy, and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already approved what you do. Let your garments be always white. Let not oil be lacking on your head. Enjoy life with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life that he has given you under the sun, because that is your portion in life in your toil at which you toil under the sun. Whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, for there is no work or thought or knowledge or wisdom in Sheol to which you are going. Again I say that under the sun the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to the intelligent, nor favor to those with knowledge. But time and chance happen to them all. For a man does not know his time, like fish that are taken in an evil net, and like birds that are caught in a snare, so the children of man are snared at an evil time when it suddenly falls upon them. So again, Solomon teaches us three things from this passage. The first of these, he talks about the infinite God. The context to understand this passage really begins in chapter 8, specifically verse 9. Solomon, as we all know, gained wisdom that was unmatched throughout history. And he learned through all of this wisdom that God is sovereign and that he is in control of everything. Chapter 9, verse 1 says, "But all this I laid to heart, examining it all, how the righteous and the wise and their deeds are in the hand of God. Whether it is love or hate, man does not know. Both are before him." We back up to chapter 8, verse 9, and we realize that Solomon, in all of his wisdom, really struggled with the sovereignty of God and that how many times evil overcomes good, even though God is in control of everything. But we read verse 14 of chapter 8, which says, "There is a vanity that takes place on earth, that there are righteous people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the wicked, and there are wicked people to whom it happens according to the deeds of the righteous. I said that this is also vanity." Solomon knows that God wants us to understand that bad things happen. He wants us to understand what is really important in life and teaches us that through these lessons that we learn when things don't go our way. There's three things from chapter 8, verse 9 through 17 that I believe we can learn, that I believe Solomon wishes to teach us. The first of these is that God sets things right, as it says in verse 12 and 13. The second is that a person should enjoy life and enjoy the gifts that God has given him and not dwell on the evil in the world. And the third is that God has knowledge of all things. He alone understands everything, so we shouldn't question him, and we should be happy that he's in control. This explains verse 1 of chapter 9 when he says, "For all this I've laid to heart." This is something that we are called to do. We need to think of all these things, but then lay it to heart, still give it over to God. Solomon understands that God is in control of this world, and this is something we should all understand as well. We should all be thankful for it. I know that as much as I can get caught up in wishing I could control certain things, when I take a step back and think about it, I am much more thankful that I am not in control and that God is. I know He's going to do a much better job than I ever could. So Solomon understands that God is in control, and we need to do this as well. heard a story about a cowboy who went to a broker, was going to buy some life insurance. The broker asked him if he'd had any accidents within the past year. The cowboy replied and said, "No, but I was kicked by a horse and was chased by a raging bull and was bitten by a snake that laid me up for a while." And the broker said, "Well, aren't those accidents?" And the cowboy said, "Well, no, they meant to do it." This is a recurring theme in Ecclesiastes, that God is in control and there are no accidents with God. God doesn't make mistakes when it comes to His sovereignty. Perhaps the most well-known passage in Ecclesiastes comes from chapter 3, where Solomon says, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." That's Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 10. And verse 11 tells us that God makes everything beautiful in its own way and in His own time. The Lord put it similarly in Matthew 5:45, when He said, "God sends His sunshine on the good and the evil, and His rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." This past year in Europe, there was a 90-year-old man who was being released from the hospital for struggling with the coronavirus. He was informed as he was leaving by the doctor that he was going to be charged 500 euros for using a ventilator that he'd only been on for less than half a day. The man began to cry. The doctor reassured him, telling him if he didn't have insurance or if he didn't have the money, the hospital could work something out with him. The man replied, saying, "Well, I have insurance and money's not the issue. I have plenty of money. But I just realized that for 90 years, I've been breathing God's good air, and He's never sent me a bill for it. And I've also realized how pitiful of a job I've done in thanking Him for that." We have to know that God is in control of everything. We have to understand that God is sovereign if we're going to appreciate and understand what Solomon says in the rest of the chapter. So, Solomon on the infinite God. Secondly, Solomon talks about the insanities of life. There's so many things that go wrong in life, as we know. There's so many tragedies that occur every day. We all have something that we could think of, I know. Everybody has something that has gone wrong in their life, and many things tend to go wrong every day. But Solomon knows this, and he talks about this in this passage. He knows that things are going to go wrong, and we have to be prepared for that. And specifically in verses 2 through 6, he speaks of three things that I believe that we can learn from this passage. I'm going to go ahead and read chapter 9, verses 2 through 6. "It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. And the good one is, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath. This is an evil in all that is done under the sun, that the same event happens to all. Also, the hearts of the children of man are full of evil. They live, and madness is in their heart while they live. And after that, they go to the dead. But he who is joined with all the living has hope, for a living dog is better than a dead lion. For the living know that they will die, but the dead know nothing, and they have no more reward, for the memory of them is forgotten. Their love and their hate and their envy have already perished, and forever they have no more share in all that is under the sun." When the first thing that we can learn from this passage is the certainty of death. When Solomon is talking about the destiny of each man, he's not talking about heaven, hell, heaven or hell. He's talking about physical death and that it awaits us all. Hebrews 9:27, "For it is appointed unto man once to die." The idea is this isn't an appointment that we can make. This isn't an appointment that we know of. This isn't an appointment that we can change to fit our agenda or our schedule. It's coming one way or another, and we have to be ready for it when it does come. Solomon realized this, and his life took several different paths, some good and some, as we know, very bad. Someone put it better than I could, saying, "Some people draw the wrong conclusion from what Solomon says here. They assume that since there is nothing they can do to change the fact that death awaits all, they cast away all restraint and live for themselves. They become full of evil and madness, and use proverbs such as "a living dog is better than a dead lion" to reassure them. Solomon knew this. He experienced all of this. And by the end of his life, he came to a conclusion. And that conclusion comes at the end of his book, Ecclesiastes chapter 12, verses 13 and 14. "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment, with every secret thing, whether good or evil." Hebrews 9:27 closes, "For it is appointed unto a man once to die, but after this the judgment." We know there is another life after death, a better life, a life with an eternity in heaven, if we will choose to fear God and keep His commandments, if we'll choose to live in the way that He would have us to. So the second thing we can learn from this passage is that chance controls everyone's life. This is just another aspect of our mortality, that we are governed by chance and time, even though God is in control of everything. Solomon shows that no matter how capable we are, no matter how qualified we are, we still have things that are out of our control. He demonstrates this in five ways. The fastest runner is outran. The strongest army is defeated. The wise man starves. The talented man is poor, and the gifted man remains obscure. I thought it was ironic. My dad and I were talking about something similar yesterday. I think it got started with songwriting, and how the most talented songwriter doesn't always end up on the top of the Billboard charts. That's the way that things go. The best baseball team doesn't always win the World Series. The best hockey team doesn't always win the Stanley Cup. Alabama doesn't always win the national championship. We have to understand that when we play the game, sometimes we win, sometimes we lose. Sometimes things go our way, sometimes they don't. And that's just life. That's just the way it is. The third thing we can learn from this passage is that calamity befalls us all. We can never anticipate or predict when hard times will happen. They come out of nowhere. I know that, you know, a little over a year ago, none of us would have heard of the coronavirus. Nobody would have thought of wearing a mask or having to use the little packets for the Lord's Supper every Sunday. But that's just the way that life is. Things happen, and they often happen so quickly that they can change in days or hours. It's so easy to get caught up in this tragedy, and there often seems to be no rhyme or reason to what is happening to us. Solomon shows this in two ways: a fish being caught in a net and a bird being caught in a net. They are just swimming or flying along, minding their own business, and then all of a sudden they run into a net that they could not have seen. That's the way that life is. There's no way around that. Sometimes we are caught by that net. Someone once said, "Solomon has resigned. The moment of death is not ours to choose, but we don't deny or ignore death either. Neither do we let it dominate or define us. We enjoy life while we had it." James Dobson, founder of Focus on the Family, tells a story of playing Monopoly with his family one night. He was beating them handily. He had hotels everywhere. He had all of the railroads. You couldn't get around the board without paying him money. And by the end, he'd beaten his family, and they threw everything down in disgust and just left him. He said, I had all of this wealth, but I put others down to achieve it. I had gained so much, but I had no one to share it with. And then the final conclusion, at the end, I had to put it all back in the box. So this is Solomon's thoughts on the infinite God, and secondly, the insanities of life. And third and finally, he gives us a few instructions for life. He gives us four examples from verses 7 through 10, four plain examples. The first of these is to eat every meal as if it were a banquet. And this really is true of us in America. I know for sure every meal is a banquet. I don't know if this is technically correct, but I've heard it said at least that we throw away more food in a day than some third world countries see in a year. And this is something that I know we can often forget, that we get caught up in and we forget that how blessed we are, even when it comes to something as simple as a meal. And if we'll celebrate that meal as if it were a banquet, we'll be more on our way to being more content. Because what do we really want? Like, truly, we want food on the table, a warm bed, a roof that doesn't leak, and someone to share it with. Secondly, celebrate every day as if it were a party. Solomon uses white garments and oil. It seems to equate to dressing up for a party and maybe wearing the cologne or perfume that goes along with that. It's not to say that every day is a party, but every day is something to be celebrated as if it were. And that's how we need to view life. We'll be happier that way. Thirdly, enjoy marriage as if on the honeymoon. I've heard an old man say, "Well, my wife and I have been married for 40 years. We're still on the honeymoon." Solomon speaks from experience about drifting away from that honeymoon stage. He, as we know, in 1 Kings chapter 11, he drifted away from his faith. He married outside his faith, and that pulled him away from God. And it really was his ultimate downfall. But it seems as if he's looking back now at the end of his life and remembering how happy a good marriage truly can make him. It seems as if he's remembering the Song of Solomon days and the love that he possessed back then. So, fourthly, work as if it were your last day. Do what you love and you won't work a day in your life. I know it's a cliche, and it's nowhere in the Bible, but it is at least true, and it's nearly a commandment in some aspects. Also, you could think of as if every day were Friday, or the day before a vacation, something of the sort. I read a story about a businessman who came upon a fisherman who was sitting lazily by his boat. He asked him why he wasn't out fishing, and the fisherman said he'd caught enough fish for the day. The businessman asked him why he wasn't catching more than he had to. He could have caught more fish and sold them to make money, and then caught more fish and bought nicer boats, nicer nets, and caught even more fish, and eventually he'd be rich. He'd have a fleet just like the businessman. And the fisherman replied, saying, "Well, what would I do with that?" The businessman said, "Well, you could then sit down and enjoy life." And the fisherman gazed out at the sea and said, "Well, what do you think I'm doing right now?" Ecclesiastes, earlier on in chapter 2, verse 24 and 25, says, "There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also, I saw, is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment?" Someone said, "One day at a time, that's how we're supposed to live. There may not be a tomorrow, but there will be an eternity. Live as if today were your last. It might be." I wish I could have said something that poetic, but I had to steal that. It really is beautiful. We have no idea what's to come, but we know there is an eternity and that we need to live and be prepared for that every day. We'll close that point with the words of Paul from 1 Corinthians 15:58. "Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. For as much you know, your labor in the Lord is not in vain." So to conclude, Solomon had everything anyone could ever search for. He was wise, he was rich, he tried everything under the sun. And what did he learn about contentment? He teaches us in this passage about the infinite God, the insanities of life, and then gives us some instructions for life. What did he really teach us about contentment? He told us we need to find meaning in what we have instead of searching for what we don't have. The preacher had it all. He was always after the next big thing. He always thought something could give him happiness, could give him peace. But he learned over his long life and through his wisdom that the things that could truly make him happy were already given to him by God. The simple things in life that he gives us every day. A king, long ago, I heard a story. He fell into a great depression, and he kept asking his advisors what he could do to get out of it. Nothing seemed to work. So eventually, one of the advisors told him to go out and find the happiest man in the kingdom and to bring him his shirt. So the king was willing to try anything. He sent out his servants and gave them those instructions. A few days later, they came back and they said, "Well, Your Majesty, we found who we believe to be the happiest man in the kingdom, but unfortunately, he wasn't wearing a shirt." I don't know of a better way to conclude this lesson than to reiterate Solomon's words at the end of his book. Again, Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14. "The end of the matter, all has been heard. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment with every secret thing, whether good or evil." One of those commandments is to be baptized and to repent of your sins. If you need to come forward and be baptized today, or maybe you've lost focus on fearing God and keeping His commandments and you need to come and find your way back, would you please come as we stand and as we sing?